Welcome to the second part of our cultish true crime series, Inside the Mind of Manson. Come join us.
Inside. It's in the back. The front. No, it's in the back. No, it's in the front. No, it's in the back. They shoved it in the back. They put it in the back. All the love in the back. Get in the back. All the love, get in the back, boy. And they call it your subconscious. Remember Freud? And the front is your computer. And I call him.
All right, welcome back. Once again, to this cultish true crime, our first one ever, the second part of our first ever true crime, and a super sleuth.
Yeah.
It's good to see you. The Andrew, you were the detective. What's that one video game where it's like the L.A. Noir? Is that the L.A. Noir?
L.A. Noir, yeah.
Yeah, L.A. Noir, where it's like that, but you're doing all this detective work.
That's cool.
But yeah, you were the detective. We are going to be, investigating, we're sleuthing detective, figuring all this out.
Our armchair detective.
Yes. We also have Robin the Mindhunter.
Oh.
I love that.
Dr. Robin Hall.
Oh, I love that too.
I'm so glad to be back. I love that. Can I use that now as a nickname online?
Yes.
Okay, awesome.
You are.
Robin
the Mindhunter.
Done.
It's always been Robin of the Hood in the past, so I like Robin the Mindhunter.
So it's funny, so that song where we Charlie was quite the musical artist. We haven't gotten quite into the musical aspect of this whole story of the Mind of Manson. That had a huge play. We'll probably introduce that in this series. But of course, he's talking about Freud, of course. And again, we're kind of delving into not only Charlie's worldview, but what's the best way to make sense of this whole story that has fascinated? This is one of the definitive cult stories, one of the definitive crime stories, culture stories, like you said, dozens of books, just tons of different icons. It's almost sort of that they sort of, the Beatles in and of themselves, they were such a cultural icon.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But then you have someone like Charlie Manson. I remember one time, Bono from U2, during their early musical career, they did a cover of Helter Skelter. And in it, he did a live version. It's off the album Rattle and Hum. And he says, this is a song Charlie Manson stole from the Beatles. We're stealing it back.
Mm.
And that's what he says.
Right.
So that is just another example of just this all over it. We got to figure out how to make sense of it. So all that being said, let's jump back into the whole story. So the last episode, we introduced this crime. And so we mentioned Abigail Folger and we briefly mentioned everyone else, but we kind of want to go more in depth of who these people were. So we are going to go into their victimology.
Yeah.
So just real quickly, because we want to, you're a true crime person.
Yes.
And it's been a while because I actually went to college initially for criminal justice studies.
Oh, wow.
And
that's
so
cool. I didn't know that.
That was a long time ago. Like 9/11 happened right around when I was going to community college. It was a little while back.
Oh, dang.
So 2 years, 20 years.
It's always good to define terms. So real quickly, when we say victimology, how do we define that?
Sure. So victimology is really, it's the study of the victims of a crime. So we learn a lot, like forensic psychologists, forensic psychiatrists use what we know about victims and what happened in a crime to put together the pieces of that crime into a narrative or a story that helps make sense or would make sense to a jury.
Mm-hmm.
It helps us kind of clarify motive, which is really important. And actually, when we get into more of the specifics of the trial that took place following these crimes, we'll talk about how the motive that was introduced by the lead investigator on the case was really groundbreaking and brand new. Nobody had ever done it before. And we'll kind of talk about a little bit of the psychology involved in that too. So anyway, when to answer your question, when anybody's talking about victimology, we're really talking about the study of the victims, their behaviors, their lifestyle, their personality, what places them in the position they are in, you know, when the crime takes place. So during the last episode, we talked a little bit more, we talked more in detail about Abigail Folger. So just to review that, Abigail Folger, she died at 25 years old. She is hypothesized to have been the second victim killed at the Cielo Drive house, with most people agreeing that Stephen Parent was the first victim killed out on the lawn before the perpetrators entered the house. So Abigail was living with her friend Sharon Tate, or Sharon Tate Polanski, who was 8 months pregnant at the time with her first child, a boy. And Sharon was 26 years old. So we've got Abigail and Sharon both extremely young. Abigail, we mentioned previously, she is the heiress to the Folger Coffee fortune. And every time I say that, I just want to sing the Folger theme song, you know. Best part of waking up. Okay. So anyway, that was her. She had a lot of money, and she was dating the third victim believed to have been killed that night, Wojciech Frykowski. So he was a friend of Roman Polanski's and Sharon's. He was from a wealthy Polish family. And he was staying with the Polanskis at that time at the Cielo Drive address. So he was dating Abigail Folger. And I don't know if I meant, he was 32. So we've got Stephen Parent, who was 18, Abigail Folger, who was 25, Sharon Tate, 26, and Wojciech, who was 32. The fourth person now believed to have been killed that evening was a man named J.C. Bring. So he was 35 years old that night, and he was a very good friend of Sharon Tate's and Roman Polanski's, but more specifically Sharon. They had actually had a relationship, a romantic relationship with each other previously. And J.C. Bring was very well known in the Hollywood community. He owned a salon. And so, you know, he was working on a lot of other actors in that time period. Is very well known within the Hollywood community. And he and Sharon, you know, by all accounts, had a very special, close, intimate relationship, a very strong friendship. And he was also at the Cielo Drive house that evening. So the last person to be killed that evening was Sharon Tate, who was, like we said before, 8 months pregnant at the time with her first child. You know, we got into some of the details of the crime when Andrew read the police report last time, but it was particularly gruesome. These were not sniper shots that were taken, you know, a mile away. These were up close and personal attacks, stabbings, gunshot wounds at close range.
But even like, for example, there are particular type of arts of knife fighting. There's, I can't remember the name of it, but there's a Filipino type of knife fighting that's very precision, very accurate. If you look at how special forces, when they want to dispatch, they want to go ahead and disable someone and get rid of them, it's very quick and very precise. You're really kind of looking at a bunch of really hippies,
right,
that were really under the influence of this cult leader, so their expertise was not weaponry.
Right.
So you're really kind of dealing with that. They're just trying to go in and kill them.
Right. It's frenzied. It's calculated, but it's chaotic. It isn't the work of a trained killer. It's the work of untrained killers who are being manipulated by their cult leader, Charles Manson.
And there are other things that happen too. Is that, you know, when we start to unravel too, a lot of the worldviews of Manson, and really not just the physical, psychological aspect, but really the spiritual aspect of what they were involved in, and how Charlie Manson, what he was really kind of tapped and sourced into. Was it just his sociological environment? Was he just a byproduct of his upbringing, which made him to do the things that he did, or was it something deeper? So one of the things to take into account is that when Wojciech Frykowski, when he was confronted by Tex Watson, he... and he asked him who he was, Watson said, "I am the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business."
Right.
Very well known.
Yeah.
Right.
So did he just say that, or was there something deeper going on? That's a question we have to ask. And one other thing, too, we're looking at 1960s L.A. So you look at, for example, L.A. right now, and especially what's also interesting, given current circumstances with L.A. being in lockdown, L.A. is such a huge, giant metropolis, and it was kind of really known for just all the smog everywhere in the LAX and how crowded it is all the time. But now the skyline is completely clear with all the lockdowns and stuff. It was a lot wider environment, I mean, versus back then.
Mm-hmm.
So what you'll see, though, is that back then you didn't really have all the Instagram accounts, Twitter, all your social media followings and stuff like that. You really, LA and Hollywood at that time was a lot closer knit. Everything was in close quarters with each other. And that's honestly one of the reasons too, why Charlie, being the type of person that he's influenced as we get into it, was able to really get in contact with certain people of high influence that ended up leading up to this. So when you look at someone, for example, the hairstylist, he was involved and he had a very close relationship with Sharon Tate. He is he's a celebrity hairstylist.
Right.
So there's probably a lot of other celebrities. They're all walking together, all hobnobbing together, kind of doing their thing. That was just the environment at the time.
Yeah.
So, all right. So what we want to do is so we kind of have the understanding of this is who they were. This is what happened to them, and how we kind of piece those things together. Was there anything else we want to kind of delve into? Any other thoughts on the crime? We're covering just a little bit of the victims, who they are, the victimology. Right. Anything else we want to cover before we kind of jump back into the evolvement of Charlie and where he went from here as far as his criminal lifestyle, which led him up to that?
Well, I think it's probably important that we mention who was originally hypothesized, and now it's generally just agreed as fact, who was there and committed these murders.
Right.
I think it's really, really important, and it speaks to the uniqueness of this crime.
Mm-hmm.
So Charles Manson, while he was the puppet master, the idea, you know, cultivator and giver here, he was not present for this crime.
No.
There are lots of accounts. I even think that Quentin Tarantino does a fabulous job in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, in kind of putting together this idea that the girls were directed by Charlie to do whatever Tex told them to do.
Yes.
And that was, you know, that was really the directive. And I think, you know, even in the police reports, you kind of see that hypothesis come out. With Stephen Parent, he was kind of the wrong place, the wrong time. If he hadn't been there that night, you know, we can kind of hypothesize that he would have still been alive.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't that they went there with the intent or express intent to kill Abigail Folger and Sharon Tate. Mm-hmm. They went there with the intent to kill who was ever in that house.
Yeah, it was in there.
And that's what they did. So, but it is really important that we all understand that Charlie was not there that night physically. He was not physically there that night. So the people that committed these homicides were Charles Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Linda Kasabian. So once we get into the psychology and the dynamics of the actual family, the cult, the family, we'll talk a lot more about each one of their individual psychological makeups. But mm-hmm. I think it's really important before we leave the crime that everybody understands Charles Manson. When you think of the crime, you think of his face, right?
Yes.
But he wasn't there that night.
Mm-hmm.
So, which makes this a unique crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll talk more about that when we get to the trial, but it makes prosecuting him really interesting.
Yes.
Right.
And one other thing to note, and we'll go ahead and mention this too, is that this is really the main crime that's kind of centered around, again, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. They kind of focused in on this whole particular crime.
The Cielo Drive murders.
But that's not the only murder that was really known for. So the day after the murders of the Tate Polanski home, Manson, he moved onto another home in Los Feliz, and basically the lives of, it was the LaBianca murders.
Yeah.
So tell us just a little bit about that, because that took place right afterwards, and that's one of the things too. These two murders put together is what really spiked the panic. These two, it wasn't just that murder, it's these two back to back.
Right. So, and I think it's important too to note that these two crimes, the LaBianca murders and the Tate Polansky murders, were not connected. They took place in different criminal jurisdictions. So it was not until later in the investigation that the connection between the two crimes was even made, which really stalled the investigation out. Mm-hmm. And that was really a matter of jurisdiction. At the time, the two departments didn't have to report to one another. So uh-huh. they didn't. To talk a little bit about the LaBianca murder. So those occurred on the night of August 10th, 1969. So one day after the Tate Polansky murders. And the victims in that crime were Lino LaBianca. He was 44 years old, and he was the husband to the second victim, Rosemary LaBianca, mm-hmm. and he owned a grocery store. He was a proprietor. So his wife, Rosemary LaBianca, was 38 at the time of her murder. And their house, their Los Feliz house, was targeted by Manson specifically. So this crime is a little bit different with regards to who was present, and we'll talk about that in terms of perpetrators. Charlie was actually at this house, and he participated in binding, restraining the LaBiancas. He tied them up. He did, however, leave the house prior to their murders. So, again, he wasn't there when the actual, when the ultimate crime was committed. He participated physically in the LaBianca crimes, mm-hmm. Like he did not in the Tate crime, but mm-hmm. he had left again. And I think that really speaks to kind of his whole overall quality as a psychopath. He's always thinking two or three steps ahead. And when I try and conceptualize Charlie, in his mind, I can imagine him thinking, well, how are they going to pin this on me? I wasn't even there.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's also a trust knowing that this is like, I know my followers are going to do this. So I don't even have to second guess, no ifs, ands, or buts, that they're going to kill them exactly the way that I told them to.
Well, and he already knows that's true because it happened the night before.
Yep.
Right. I mean, so imagine the ego rush, the adrenaline rush that you're feeling as the leader of this cult. I mean, of course, he's not calling his family a cult, mm-hmm. but that's what it is. And these people, literally by the word of his mouth, did this heinous thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a high, what an absolute mm-hmm. rush as a manipulative leader of a mm-hmm. group of people. I mean, you're feeling invincible, untouchable at this point. And he knows he doesn't have to be the one to pull the trigger or to, you know, plunge the blade. Mm-hmm. All he has to do is give the word. So right. I think it really speaks to his grandiosity, that mm-hmm. narcissistic ego, and just mm-hmm. what he must have been experiencing at that point, the adrenaline he must have been experiencing, knowing mm-hmm. all he has to do is give the word and this happens.
Yes, and speaking of thinking ahead, I just want to mention one thing that happened, this crime, and we won't really kind of give any details until we expand on this in later on in the series, but this is one of the things that happened is that, and again, this is, if you have kids around, you know, this is a true crime series. We've given warnings before. We're talking about sin. We're talking about crime. We're talking about murder. So this, like I said, Andy Wilson said, this world is rated R. You have to make note of that. But after they were murdered, they took their blood and they wrote on "Death to Pigs" on the refrigerator. As we know, we are right now, by the time this, who knows where we will be by the time this series gets released, there is so much unprecedented racial tension. And we all know what that references to, as far as pigs are concerned, and I don't need to give any description. You know what that is. So there's reason and intent behind why Charlie did that. We'll expand upon that, but then again, that was part of the crime, writing pigs in blood on the refrigerator so he knew people would see that.
Right.
Why did he do that? Stay tuned for one of the upcoming episodes.
Yeah.
So, what we want to go ahead and do, let's go ahead and jump back in. Now that we've kind of gone into these crimes more in depth, we're kind of back there, kind of filling in some more details. So, Charlie, we've talked some about his adolescence, doing some sort of misdemeanors, stealing $100, buying some food, taking that to the next level where he is holding a razor blade up to a boy's throat, sodomizes him, and now he's getting transferred out of a juvenile facility to different facilities. And so, it's, as we said, there just seemed to be this continual... really, he was always choosing a lifestyle of crime. It's what he knew. It's really where he seemed to be able to function and operate. So yeah, as we talked about, he went from, after he committed that horrific act, all of a sudden he flipped around his personality, as we said in the last episode. He became their ideal person. They bought it hook, line, and sinker. So his life of crime continued. What's interesting, too, is that in 1955, Manson, he married Rosalie Willis. She was a waitress from Wheeling. And the couple actually produced a child, Charles Manson Jr. And so he worked as a parking lot attendant, as a busboy, and he also stole cars. So
you thought he was going on the straight and narrow.
So you thought like, oh, you're there, Charlie, almost. I don't know. But then all of a sudden, he's back there.
Right.
So in October of that year, he was arrested for auto theft, and he is sent into 5 years probation. And then it says arrested for a second time for driving hot cars interstate in September 1955. Manson got off easy with, 5 years probation. Same bullet point here. And then he celebrated by skipping a court date in Florida on pending charges of auto theft. And his probation was promptly revoked. He was picked up in Indianapolis on March 14th, 1956, where he was sent to federal prison at Terminal Island, California, mm-hmm. winning parole on September 30th, 1958. So here's what's interesting, too, and maybe you can delve into this, Robin, is so we talked about his younger adolescence. He's so 14 years old is when he did his first sort of petty theft. And so by the time he was 26, he had spent 14 years of his life in some sort of form of custody or probation or juvenile hall.
Some kind of institution.
Yes.
Right. So that's more than half of his life.
That's what I was thinking, more than half.
About the typical, the typical normal upbringing. You have the adolescence going into puberty all the way up to adulthood when you're 18. And the usual things that happens in a normal family of high school graduation, going to college.
Prom.
Right. All the basic things that we kind of think and identify with as far as what would be the quote unquote normal expectations.
Or at least normal before COVID-19.
Yes.
Right.
Right. So not only that, you have, again, the relationship of abandonment and this childhood trauma, but dealing with, think about right now, someone with all the different juvenile and sort of this trouble with prison, how do you think that affected his psyche that many years in this particular environment, either in custody or probation?
Well, I think, in a word, poorly. I think it really impacted him from a typical viewpoint very poorly. From his viewpoint, it probably helped him feel much more capable of adapting to his surroundings. So he didn't really have primary caregivers outside of these institutions that were there for. I mean, there's a lot of information about an uncle who tried to take a little bit of care of him, when Charlie's mom really showed no interest in it. But he didn't have a really good core group of caregivers before he went into these institutions. And so when he went in, you can imagine who then became his primary influences. Right. Mm-hmm. So these are individuals that are practiced and not great because they're all caught. Right. Mm-hmm. But practiced at conning people, at manipulating people. So he starts to learn those ropes, so to speak. And really, I mean, in my opinion, this is where he would develop that ability to chameleon so well. Mm-hmm. It's all reinforced. And once you learn that you can lie and manipulate to give people what they want and then you get what you want. Again, you see like people as, a means to an end. So in terms of his overall psychology, my guess is that when he started to feel important, within the context of an institution. So he does this whole song and dance and now he's the model ideal inmate, right? Yeah. And that's not what they would have called him at this reform school, but for lack of a better word, that's really what he was.
He was reformed a little bit.
Yeah. Reformed, right? So at least he gave that appearance of being reformed. Yeah. So he starts to feel important, and this is a person who has never ever felt importance. Mm. I mean, not even to his mother, right? Andrew and I were just reading on the break that at one point his mother allegedly sold him for a pitcher of beer.
As a child.
As a child. So, I mean, that's kind of what we're dealing with in terms of how, you know, how he, who taught him and how he learned the value of people. Mm. So, you know, that was really just reinforced throughout his time in institutions. He learned how to be a criminal. He learned how to manipulate people to give him what he wanted. And he got really good at it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And so we're not, so when you talk about too, we're talking about education, right? And usually a lot of times people think about, okay, how do we make someone a better person? Or how do we make society better? We just need to have more education. We need to educate them more. And there's a path. I think it's Voddie Baucham says, you know, someone who's good at they don't have a changed heart. They're stealing hubcaps. You get them educated, they're going to steal the whole car.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the point. And so with Charlie, you'll see that there's certain programs in these prisons where they're trying to quote-unquote reform the people. Let's get them educated. Let's teach them classes. Let's do these particular things. But again, Charles Manson is someone that is made in the image of God. And, you know, the thing that was amazing too in the Bible, it talks about, and such were some of you, and it talks about all these different categories of people that will not fit into the kingdom of heaven. But yeah, people from the beauty of the gospel is that you have people that are saved from every tongue, tribe, and nation. And that while your past may explain you, it doesn't define you. Mm. And that's a huge thing. Your identity is in Christ.
Right.
And that's the beauty of the gospel. But what's interesting coming back to Charles Manson is that one of the books that he got really influenced by while he was in prison was How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie.
Right.
That's one of the most popular books in self-improvement, self-development. So one of the, I'll just say one thing about the book, which is very interesting, is that this is something that really kind of gave, almost reinforced something that Charlie in many aspects was already doing. But one of the things that Dale Carnegie talks about in his book is to inspire someone to do, like get someone to do what you want to do, but sort of in inception, plant the idea that this was what they wanted to do all along.
Right.
So they really think this is me choosing to do this, but there's subtle steps of undue influence,
right?
Which one, that you'll see that as far as someone who's a narcissist and a psychopath do that to manipulate people. But that's also just, again, that's one of the manipulative tactics of the cults. They have a set in which they want to get people to do something with undue influence in a groupthink, but people think, oh, I'm just going to go ahead and do this, not realizing that this is just sort of things that were set in motion.
Right.
So you had How to Win Friends and Influence People. That was a big aspect of it. So one of the things that's incredibly interesting, too, is that he continued this life of crime. So he ended up being divorced, and his ex-wife retained custody of the child, and then Manson was released on parole. And what happened after he went through all this reforming and everything else? He became a pimp.
Yeah.
In Southern California. So this is where, this is just one of those stories where, as much as I've studied Manson, I've told you, and so now with reading his books, when I hear a quote from him, I hear it in his voice.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
And if for someone who was nowhere near even being born or existing when Charlie was alive, that's just incredibly intriguing, the fact that that's the type of personality influence that he had. So on May 1st, 1969, it says he was jailed in Los Angeles on charges of forging and cashing a U.S. Treasury check for $37.50. Like, of a small amount.
Right.
So I have a theory on why that happened, and I think the author of the book in which I got this from has a theory in it as well. So he was interrogated by Secret Service agents. According to several testimonies, Charlie, he swallowed the check when Secret Service agents momentarily had their backs turned. And from what I understood, there was something that he did to get them to turn their backs, in which he swallowed the check.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Once more, and also he escaped with probation, which was swiftly revoked with his April 1960 arrest for pimping and transporting whores interstate, or prostitutes.
Right.
So, yeah, quite a life of crime.
Right.
And just nonstop.
Just totally calculated. And you see this so much. We talked in the last episode, we tried to set the stage a little bit for, you know, what psychologists, what people who work clinically in mental health, how they describe psychopathy and sociopathy. When you're working with individuals like this, you know, criminal narcissists, you have to be on your toes in a way that you don't in any other population, because they are constantly grooming you. They are constantly manipulating you. I have an example, you know, even in my own clinical practice, I kind of always refer back to my time at the state hospital because it was such an integral part of my training. I was there during the Clinton-Trump race to the White House. One of the residents that was on the sexually violent predator unit asked me what my political affiliation was one day, which I responded, you know, curtly with, "That's none of your business, and I'm not going to tell you." And then 2 or 3 minutes later, I mean, completely diverted away from that question, he asked me an anecdotal question that would have aligned me as either somebody on the left or the right. Okay, so very calculated. And something that, had I not been very, very attuned to, like, the possibility of him trying to groom me, I would have missed completely. But that kind of thing, okay, I'm going to ask you this and you're not going to give it to me, so how am I going to get the information about you that I want? And you see that with Charlie all, I mean, all over the place. And it's so fascinating that in this interaction with a Secret Service agent, he distracts them long enough to swallow the check. I mean, it's just such a classic psychopath move.
Well, and not only that, I mean, he found plenty of ways to get by. I mean, in fact, it was $37.50. So I don't think in that particular instance, and I believe the author that I read, just expounding upon this, is that this was more about the thrill of doing it versus the money. And also even the possibility that this, he could have actually had the, like, he had, like, his main thing was to say, I mean, it could have been, I don't remember when it, exactly after reading whenever this book, but the fact that it was able to manipulate these Secret Service agents, that's worth a whole lot more as far as influence and getting people to follow you than $37.50.
Well, imagine what that does to the ego, right? Like, I just bested, outsmarted, tricked these, you know, educated or trained,
the
you
best of the best.
The best of the best, right? And and it just feeds into that, like, grandiosity, that self-idolization, you know, that I am God kind of concept, which we see all the way through Charlie's, the dogma that he created in his religion, you know, that he, you know, ultimately ended up promoting. I mean, he called himself Jesus multiple times, which is something we see across a lot of cults, right?
And what you'll end up seeing, and won't go into, so he was just sort of, again, all over the place, life of crime, where a lot of you mentioning his worldview and ideas and philosophies, it wasn't just Dale Carnegie, but there's a couple other things that came into play, and let's go ahead and jump into that. So a lot of things took place when he got Manson in 1961, he was transferred to a federal penitentiary at McNeil Island in Washington. And at that time, he got a hold of Scientology. In fact, he was and he talked extensively about his influences of that. I forget the particular book. It wasn't Dianetics. I think it was some sort of pamphlet or booklet of the what he got. But he got extensively influenced by L. Ron Hubbard and his sorts of thinking.
Well, and he also made proclamations. This is hearsay because I'm not sure that he ever went on record saying it, but his followers, the members of the family, would say that he kind of touted that he was clear, like he had made it to that ultimate whatever beta level that you can reach in Scientology, and he did it on his own and he did it in prison. So
and just to go to clarify too, what happens after you become clear according to Scientologists is then you become an operating Thetan, and then you learn how to manipulate matter, energy, space, in time.
Yes.
So that would be kind of important to know.
And also see how his worldview and his really theology affected these murders. We're talking about bad theology kills people. So one of the things that I noticed too, this is just notes that I took down as I was kind of reading, studying, researching for this episode, is that he adopted the aspect of L. Ron Hubbard's teachings that led him the ability that sort of, all, so again, all these things always enhance his ability to control and manipulate others. So he would see, for example, that many potential prostitutes have terrible self-images, telling such girls that they didn't have to be crippled by the past, that they were immortal spirits temporarily trapped in their bodies, and they were basically good and capable of achieving anything. These could be powerful recruitment techniques. And so, sure enough, the three people, out of all the people, aside from Tex Watson, all the people who are part of the Cielo Drive murders and also the La Bianca murders, they are all female, aside from Tex Watson.
Yep.
So you have that. And not only that, you also have the majority of the Manson cult being female as well, too. And right, that had to do with Charlie's ability to manipulate.
Right. Most of the family members, quote unquote, were women.
Yes. And so one of the things, too, is that he got really into music.
Yes.
That's where he got introduced. In fact, it was there that he, and I'll go into a second, too, but I believe he was there in prison. He was in a prison cell, and that's where he first started hearing the music from the Beatles playing. And that's inside prison there. And so that's what began to figure out, okay, who are they? Oh, they're famous. They're on this precedent level. And his whole thing was wanting to be known, wanting to be popular, wanting to do all those things.
Right, that grandiosity.
Yeah, that grandiosity. So sure enough, now all of a sudden, he wants to, it's not just enough to manipulate others, now to enhance my ego. Now I want to be able to do it through music. Mm-hmm. And then he got influenced through the Beatles.
Right, he did. Specifically through a song titled Helter Skelter, which I wish we could play, but I know we can't, so.
Yeah.
Copyright. Think about it, too, like, psychologically, in terms of being somebody who's grown up in this, I wouldn't even say broken household, non-household, right? Being educated by the prison system or boys' homes his whole life, trying to search for meaning and finally finding music, a way to communicate your soul and express it in a way where others can relate to you, right, to actually try to make sense to you. So I think in his music, he always gave a little bit about himself away.
Right.
Mm. You know, and he was actually able to express himself in ways that he never could before and to be vulnerable in ways he never could before. But at the same time, use the vulnerability as a way and a method to actually make people, get attracted to him.
Right, trust him.
And then manipulate them.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because a lot of what I've read, like his form of preaching, so to speak, was really through playing the guitar and singing.
Yep. It's like spoken word.
Very much so. And you do, people could, you know, this has been true of music since the beginning of music. You know, we connect with music. It almost acts like that security blanket. I get to be vulnerable here, but not directly related to myself.
There's a power in the vulnerability with music.
There is a huge power there. And I think we can bring that, back to what God says about music. You know, it makes sense that we have this emotional connection to it. And I think it's important, too, what you briefly mentioned, Jerry, the Beatles' fame and success was unprecedented. I mean, Elvis was huge, mm-hmm, but the Beatles, I mean,
they eclipsed him.
They eclipsed, and which made him really angry, actually. Right. As a also a true Beatles fan and Beatlemaniac myself, mm-hmm, I often imagine myself being one that would faint, at the sight of John, Paul, and Ringo.
My middle name's Lennon, after John Lennon, by the way.
These men came out of nowhere. They took the entire world by storm. So it's this very appealing kind of process that he's watching happen. And so Charlie starts internalizing, well, I could be this way. And it really feeds into his ego and this idea of self-worth.
Yeah. So what's also interesting, too, just another little tidbit and fact, it's like, there's so many like famous people that he comes in close quarters with. And this is the culture at the time because everyone was just so much more closer knit. And again, Charlie just had this ability to kind of find something that he wanted. So he had this desire to know music. Right. And so he ends up befriending a guy in prison known as Alvin Karpis. Or they call him Alvin Creepy Karpis. And so this was crazy. So he was kind of known as the FBI. And in fact, there's a movie that came out. There's four different people. There were, it was himself, Pretty Boy Floyd, and a guy, and Babyface Nelson. But there's another guy named John Dillinger, and that John Dillinger was played by Johnny Depp in the movie Public Enemies. Mm. So it was these bank robberies, though, it's really helped with the formulation of the FBI. I think the FBI, the director at the time was Purvis Ellison, that Christian Bale played. But what you'll end up finding out is that he was also a magician, and he played the steel guitar in prison. And so Charlie befriended him, and he got into talking about philosophy and Scientology. And so he got in all these in-depth discussions, but it was in that time that he really kind of learned, and at least in many ways, I would say, probably got him to do what he wanted, probably applying Dale Carnegie to Alvin Creepy Carpus. But it's just that it's just fascinating that Charles Manson, one of the notorious killers in American history, also befriends and learns music from one of the most notorious gangsters in American history.
Wow.
He's right up there.
Right.
And he learns music from them by listening to the Beatles, which he then uses one of their songs, which is part of his crime.
Right.
It's just so crazy how this all interconnects.
It really is. And we haven't talked at all yet about his connection with Dennis Wilson, but we'll get into that too.
Yes.
Again, and it isn't just who, like, the influential people that knew Charlie. It's, like, the influential people that knew the victims. And so, I mean, I think Jack Nicholson was at the trial. We said that J.C. Bring was this Hollywood stylist. They knew everybody at the time. Joan Didion, when Jerry and I were talking about this episode, I was telling him about a group of essays that Joan Didion wrote around these crimes called The White Album, which is where Helter Skelter is from. And she actually provided, and I'm not going to butcher it because I can't remember which defendant she actually was in contact with, but she ended up buying the dress for her to testify. And, you know, at the time she was kind of this no-name author, but I mean, now she's a household name. We really got a lot of very famous people that are involved in this story. And it makes it, I think that's part of the allure of it. It makes it even more fascinating to really read through. But Helter Skelter really became the name for the kind of apocalyptic future that Charlie was telling his followers about.
Yes. And we had talked about this. We had an episode a couple of episodes back with Gary DeMar, and he was talking a little bit about not only did Charlie Manson use how to win friends and influence people at Dale Carnegie, and also he was into Scientology, and there's a couple other different books that he was really into. One of them, there was a really popular novel, was a book called Stranger in a Strange Land. And in this book, it's about this guy, Mike. He founds his own faith and experiences, and again, this is mature content, but experiences group sex using psychic powers to make enemies disappear, and suffers a martyr's death and returns in spirit form. So,
my goodness.
Yeah. So again, what you'll see is that I think a lot, when things evolve later on at Spahn Ranch, because you see also the use of that, like, group sex was one of the big aspects of even almost like a religious and spiritual ritual being part of the family.
Yeah.
But not only that, we'll dive into their extensive use of LSD and psychedelics, which was huge in how Manson used all this to manipulate people.
Right, to suggest ideas to them, to kind of create these pseudo-farce religious experiences that were really just the result of the chemical reactions that happen when you eat poison like that in your in your body. How powerful it was to his followers. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, it's really important that we focus on his use of sex as this way of grooming and cultivating his family members.
Yes.
You know, women in the secular world, and I think even within a Christian worldview, women and men are built differently.
Yes.
And women view sex differently than men. They experience it differently than men. And so this extremely vulnerable, intimate act is now occurring between group leader and follower, which automatically cultivates a spirit of trust, as long as it's consensual, right? So, and you know, for the most part, that at least that's what everybody within the family would say. You couldn't become a family member if you didn't participate in sex with Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of making sure that he was able to assert his influence psychologically, I mean, it was genius to do that, right? And it's also right in the middle of this cultural movement of, you know, free sex, love, you know, and rock and roll, this like rebellion away from kind of the Christian ideals that had permeated culture and society, at least in the United States up until that point.
Yeah. And what I meant to say earlier, because I was talking about Gary DeMar, but in the same way how, even though it was somewhat at that time, in similar to the late 1960s, similar today is sort of like an abandoned Christian culture in many ways. This is just done in a different culture, different form. And we're kind of doing the same thing. We just have all the technology to record it with our phones and videos and see it through social media. But in regards to the fact that not only would be Charlie would be people always who are made in the image of God, they borrow from the Christian worldview in order to make sense of their own. That's true. But Charlie also borrowed from the Christian worldview to help make his own twisted ideology.
Right.
So not only did he use, Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, this strange book on psychedelics and group sex, he also was a big fan of the Bible.
He was.
And again, we talk about theology matters.
Yes.
He utilized the Bible in order to manipulate people into different apocalyptic helter-skelter. He used Revelation in order to give an apocalyptic vision of what this race war was going to be, and we'll talk more about that later on as we go, which also is connected back to the LaBianca murders.
Right, specifically Revelation 9. So, yes. You know, when we get more into the details of what, his actual ideology and what he was telling people, you know, was going to happen, we can, maybe, Jerry, we can read through that scripture just to kind of give everybody like a background, but you know, and this is true. I think, Jerry is the cult. You guys as the cultish experts. It's not uncommon for cult leaders to take bits and pieces of scripture and manipulate them, right, to their own ends, right? And you see that all over the place with Charlie. You know, God does reveal to us an apocalyptic scene, right? So, and I think that's one of the things that makes cults so dangerous is this taking of what is true and distorting it so much. But because, you know, it's kind of founded in this like inkling of truth over here, you've got the people to initially buy into it.
There's always something that you have to do with Jesus. He's the most influential and famous person in all of history. Like, all history revolves around him. So Manson with his ego, how do you get bigger than the Beatles? Oh, wait. The Beatles are actually singing about me.
Right.
I'm Jesus. So we see the same thing with cults all throughout history. They have to do something with Jesus.
Right. And to make themselves God. Right.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, too, in the same way when we initially looked at a series at Jonestown and we kind of looked at all the different variables in play, there's a lot of similarities between Jim Jones and Charles Manson.
Yes.
Where Jim Jones used a lot of issues at the time that were legitimate, talking about all the different racial divides and regarding the civil rights movement. In fact, in this, just, you know, a little tidbit, like in the state of Illinois, for example, I mean, Jim Jones did virtuous things. Was it Illinois? My mind's running a blank. Where he was initially
Indiana.
No, in Indiana, in that he was the first person in the state of Indiana to adopt a black child, which is Jim Jones Jr.
Right.
And so he did different things where I think in many times he did things that were standing up for things that were unjust, what happened to them. But then he ended up having this idea where he kind of twisted into his ideology of where he would use the Bible, but then he would twist into his idea of divine economic socialism. Again, if you haven't checked it out, go to one of our premiere episodes through Jones Colored Glasses. We'll get into that. But with that being said, what he did is that he took current events back then and he started this movement out of uncertainty.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly what Charlie Manson did as well too. And I think one of the parallels why this is even important right now, like again, as we record this episode, as we wrap things up here, is that we are in the middle of just very uncertain times. 2020 has been obviously a very wild ride. Racial tensions are through the roof, unlike anything I've ever seen before.
Right.
And we have to walk the line. Okay, how do we live as Christians? How do we get the gospel out there? How do we speak into this thing in a way that's biblical? How do we actually look at real biblical justice and look into this? Because there's a vacuum right now that if we don't as Christians, why does this matter? Because if we don't as Christians jump into this and speak into this and be salt and be light. And just for example, we'll talk on this more as we expand in the series, but the role of LSD and psychedelics played a huge, huge role. Right now, the ideas of psychedelics, DMT, and all the sorts of things is through the roof.
Yep.
Netflix just released a documentary about the, propagating the, all the wonderful aspects and ideas of LSD and how it's a good and wonderful thing.
Right. Well, and actually, even right now, like in like the psychology forefront, well, it would technically be psychiatry, like the medical study of psychological behavior. We're using not LSD, but forms of hallucinogens that you would categorize like that.
Yeah.
To treat things like post-traumatic stress disorder, panic disorders, anxiety disorders, and lots of research is coming out about these, you know, pseudo-religious experiences that help free people. So again, we're trying to mimic, you know, we're chasing after these false gods, you know, when we're looking for joy and peace in areas, you know, from idols that are made of clay that can't return what we need from them. But we're kind of seeing a resurgence of that even in like the clinical world right now. We've got, it's a relatively new treatment treat chronic anxiety and depression with ketamine. And for those of you that aren't, you know, familiar with what that is, it is a an animal tranquilizer.
Right.
So, we're really exploring all sorts of...
Which is crazy because I knew a guy in college and him and his buddies... like somewhere in the some back alley as they took cat tranquilizers and that was like, I can't believe I actually did this. Now you're mentioning it's, this is something that's being considered like in clinical studies.
I know there's several practices, psychiatric practices here even in the valley that do it, and the treatments are legal. You know, these practitioners aren't doing anything illegal or immoral according to their, you know, ethics standards. But it's just quite interesting. They're trying to replicate this, you know, this experience that we call, you know, rebirth in Christ, a new heart in Christ, you know, with false pseudo religious experiences, you know, finding yourself. And you talk to anybody who's experimented with those kinds of mind-altering drugs. I have a past myself, and you do experience a very interesting out-of-body spiritual kind of thing. And as a Christian now, I wasn't then, I understand what I was searching for, and I understand why it was so enticing and intoxicating to go into that area. But again, you know, we're talking about false gods. You know, an idol can't return what we need.
Right.
Only the Lord can do that.
You become like the idol.
And so, like I said, to wrap things up here, what we're trying to reiterate too is that even kind of leading up to this point, and there's a huge parallel right now with all the elements that made the Manson murders such a big thing. The mind of Manson, all the presence are there. Not only all things you mentioned too, but even the mental health epidemic that's in place right now, but even now even expedited given current circumstances. Not only that, brokenness in the home, which you saw exemplified in Charlie's upbringing.
Right.
So you have that there, and that's why, you know, you want to be able to bring the gospel into the situation as we explore the mind of Manson. So the last point we'll make, just a little historical account, and this will kind of go into the next part of our series as we kind of explore what led up to that horrific night in August 1969. So on March 21st, 1967, Manson, he was paroled. And it was actually over, and this is what's interesting too, it was over his own objections.
Yep.
He didn't want to be paroled. Right. So it's almost that he had a Stockholm syndrome effect to that prison life. I mean, I learned the guitar from this notorious gangster who was part of the original four, which helped formulate the FBI.
More than half his life in institutions.
Right. I mean, it's what's familiar, and it's also where he had felt important. And, you know, I don't know if this is true. I don't think that anyone could know what's actually true, but a part of me hopes that even Charlie had some, you know, glimpse into, I'm not safe out there. you know? And far be it from me to actually, you know, speculate about that. Mm-hmm. I do find it very interesting from a psychological point of view that he actually petitioned mm-hmm. against his own parole.
Yes.
It's like he never had a father, he never had a mother, but the prison always cooked his meals.
That's right.
They clothed him, they washed his clothes, they took care of him in a way mm-hmm. he had never been taken care of before. Yeah.
They gave him the only family that he had ever known. And I think when we actually really start getting into what Manson believed in terms of his theology and his mm-hmm. cultivation of the family, it yes. makes perfect sense that that's what they were called, mm-hmm. right? He was in search of that family.
Yes. So what happened leading up to the formulation of the family, which we'll jump into in our next series, is that, so against his will, he was released from Terminal Island in March 1967. At this time, he was 32 years old, and he was pretty much looking at an empty future. And at that time, he just sort of wandered and made his way to the Haight-Ashbury District in San Francisco. And that's where not only did he work at this, that where the family assembled, the cultural environment of that was known in 1967 as the Summer of Love.
The Summer of Love.
So that's something that we'll delve into in our next series. So,
and that's also where he met Gary Hinman, who ultimately introduced him to Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. So,
I know
it's just so full of everything.
So full of all mystique
all
and intrigue
things,
and all the good stuff. So we're going to continue this conversation. We have a new after show that we want you all to check out and be part of. So Andrew and I are going to hang out for a little bit after this podcast. We're going to just have sort of a post discussion about everything. So I'm super excited for this, as I always say. So to be part of that conversation and enjoy that and participate with us, go to apologiastudios.com, become an all-access member. There's tons of other content you can get, lots of really cool theological training, just real tons of content that's being updated all the time. But now you have exclusive cultish content, which is Cultish the Aftermath. So we will have aftermaths of this series, pretty much every episode moving forward. So we're going to be giving our insight, and as we continue to get more financial support, once we make this a full-time vocation, which is what we want to do, we'll be able to expand that more. So we are limited right now by your support. And I know it's uncertain out there economically, but we need this ministry to be salt and light. As we describe the environments right now, we need to be able to preach, get the gospel into all these different issues, not just the cult, but the issue of justice, the issue of how do we make sense of all the racial tensions. We have to be able to look at that and analyze it biblically. So what I would ask you to do is go to partner with us. Go to thecultistshow.com. You can donate one time or monthly. And please partner with us, help Andrew and I go full time so we can go ahead and get this content out there, get the gospel into the world, into the kingdom of the cults. So we will jump into this series next time as we explore the mind of Manson, 1967, the Summer of Love, the formulation of this family, Spahn Ranch, and everything else that entails. Talk to you guys soon on the other side in part 3.